For the week of March 28th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 47, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in the 80s, sitting in a hot tub, I'm Michael Gilts.
I assume you're talking about Hot Tub Time Machine, which was one of the movies that opened here in North America this week.
That's right.
Well, before we get started, I should tell everyone that you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. And while we have Karen Woodward and Michael Gilts here, we'll also have Lauren Shuker from the Wall Street Journal on a little later. At least we plan to. We're still trying to get a phone number or Skype address for her. As well, we'll have Roger Friedman on, who you may know from The Hollywood Reporter. However, he is no longer with The Hollywood Reporter, and that's what we have him on to talk about. We'll also be discussing a ton of news stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop, including some news about Sarah Palin, a little political news, although I guess it's reality show news. And we'll also, we're going to find out how you can get arrested for not sending a tweet. And we're going to talk about 24, the TV show, which will no longer be a TV show. But before we get into any of that, as always, we cover the North American box office with Michael Gilts taking us through it.
There's so much to talk about. I could spend all hour discussing the box office this week. The number one movie of the week is How to Train Your Dragon in 3D and 2D. It opened to $43.3 million. Not bad, not good either. At number two was Alice in Wonderland, which held at $17 million. It's at $293 million, about to pass $300 million, so it's doing very well, even though it lost a lot of its 3D screens to How to Train Your Dragon, and next week is Clash of the Titans. At number three, disappointing, depending on how you look at it, is Hot Tub Time Machine, the film from MGM with John Cusack. That grossed $13.6 million. Number four is The Bounty Hunter, the Jennifer Aniston film, which is doing okay, $12 million. It's at $38 million total. It costs $40 million to make. And at number five, Diary of a Wimpy Kid got bullied by Alice in Wonderland and How to Train Your Dragon. It grossed $10 million. So it's $35 million total. Again, it only costs $50 million to make, so it's a success, and there will be a sequel, but it could have done better if it was placed a little farther away from some other big family films. And the rest of the movies in the top 10 are just movies just sort of fading away, like Green Zone, which is a big flop, Shutter Island, which is at $120 million, but will not become Martin Scorsese's biggest grossing film in the U.S., Repo Man, another Jude Law film, big flop, Our Family Wedding, and She's Out of My League, also starring Jay Baruchel of How to Train Your Dragon. So he is the biggest movie star in the world right now. He has two movies in the top 10.
Well, a movie that's no longer in the top 10 that I didn't hear you mention is Karen's favorite movie of all time, Avatar.
Yay!
After 15 weeks in the top 10, it finally dropped out of that slot. It's the longest run since Chicago back in 2003, which is in the top 10 for 16 weeks. It made a tad more than Chicago at the box office, however, during those 15 weeks. I saw How to Train Your Dragon and Hot Tub Time Machine. I don't know about anybody else. I saw How to Train Your Dragon in 3D and 2D, and I saw Hot Tub Time Machine. So I feel incredibly prepared to talk about the movies. Did you guys see anything this weekend?
I saw Greenberg.
Oh, you did? How was it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a little confused because as I was watching it, I hated it. Really hated it. I thought it was shallow and self-indulgent and sort of boring at parts. I mean, I had people in my theater walk out. But then when I went back and I read the reviews, which are glowing, I was like, well, I guess. I mean, I guess it's sort of deep. But you know what I mean? Like, I was left kind of thinking,
peer pressure.
Like, that wasn't my experience.
Sperling, did you see anything this weekend? Did you take the kids to see How to Train Your Dragon?
No, I'm doing that today, as a matter of fact, at 4 o'clock, right after we finish recording.
Will you see it in 3D?
I will be seeing it in 3D, and I will not be seeing it in 3D IMAX because I want to actually put them through college. So we'll talk a little bit about what I'm referring to in a moment. But you said that you could talk all day or all for the entire hour about this week's box office, Michael. Why is that?
Well, Hot Tub Time Machine, for example, I would have bet money last week that no matter what people predicted the movie would make, it would do better. Because everybody I know heard the title, said, that is so stupid, I kind of want to see it. Everybody likes John Cusack. It was a very dumb concept, like Dude, Where's My Car? And Snakes on a Plane. Everybody knew the movie title. But it does seem to be a lot of goodwill for the film with John Cusack going back in time to the 80s when he was an even bigger star. And it just seemed like it was poised for great success. And $13.6 million has to be considered a disappointment unless you look at John Cusack and MGM. John Cusack has very few hit films. You look at his movies, he has a lot of bad movies and a lot of movies that have not done well at the box office at all. However,
what was his biggest hit lately? Gross Point Blank?
2012.
2012 is his biggest hit of his entire life by far. And yeah, looking at his movies, Gross Point Blank was many years ago. They made about $29 million. And it was a success, certainly a critical success. I love it. But he has very few hits, very few big hits. But then you look at 2012, which grossed $160 million in the U.S. and $600 million overseas. It grossed $766 million worldwide. It's the 32nd biggest hit of all time. How did that happen? Only 39 movies in history have grossed over $700 million. 2012 is one of them. That is totally bizarre to me. I mean, how did that happen? Then you look at MGM, and MGM – this is actually a big hit for MGM. $13 million is their biggest opening film gross in 2.5 years. You have to go back to spring of 2007 when a remake of Halloween grossed more and 1408, a horror film starring John Cusack, who is apparently their biggest star. So given the studio and who they are, opening this movie at $13.6 million is apparently a big success for them.
Here's my little bitchy story about John Cusack. This happened in the 90s. And I was in line for go to some party and at a bar or something. And he pulled the going to the front of the line and saying, "Don't you know who I am?"
Did he really? Oh.
And that's when I went from being a huge fan to just loathing the guy. And then I know Sperling, we're probably going to get sued. And then when I was inside the bar and at the bar, he was standing next to me. And I swear to God, the guy doesn't shower.
That's actually something I've noticed about John Cusack too. Whenever I've run into him, I've been like, "Really, dude? How about some shampoo? I'll buy it. My treat, okay?"
I thought I was gonna keel over and die. I was like, "What is next to me? A homeless person?" I'm like, "Oh no, it's John Cusack."
Speaking of a stinker, I really didn't like the film either. I really had, you know, middling expectations. I thought it'd be dumb, funny, maybe, and it was really. I found it just joyless. Really,
well, what about
bad.
How to Train Your Dragon?
How to Train Your Dragon, I watched an hour of in 3D. Then I had to go pick up a kid. So I had to go back the next day. And of course, the next day I was not going to spend, you know, top ticket price to see it in 3D again. So I went to see the last half hour in 2D, which was kind of fascinating. It was more fun in 3D, obviously, because it was made to be seen in 3D. The way it's shot, the way it's framed, everything about it, you could see scenes that look sort of dull or weird in 2D that would have worked better in 3D because that's how it was meant to be seen. The movie was pretty good, very typical family film, but, you know, it was nice. It's good for the kids. Typical story. It didn't have all the jokey pop culture references DreamWorks usually has. It just wasn't great. The lead guy, Jay Baruchel, had sort of a slacker dialogue thing going along. I wish it had been more classic in its approach because I liked that it wasn't a typical movie. It was dragons, Vikings. It was sort of a little offbeat, but it's still very much in the family film genre. But it was pretty good, and it's gotten great reviews. So even though the box office is disappointing, you know, well, let's see where it is at the end of the day, because if it has good legs, you know, you never know what will happen. Of course, the problem is it's in 3D, and next week is Clash of the Titans. But looking at the movie listings, a lot of theaters that list Clash of the Titans, they seem to have more screens devoted to it in 2D than 3D. I'd love to know how many 3D screens it's able to grab, because I don't know if people are going to hand them over from How to Train Your Dragon and Alice in Wonderland.
Well, we'll certainly find out next week. Certainly, Avatar and Alice in Wonderland had to turn over a few screens to it. 355 screens, in fact, for Alice in Wonderland. And even so, it didn't really make as much money as DreamWorks was hoping. Last year, this same weekend, you had Monsters vs. Aliens earning $59.3 million. And this year, you have, you know, $43 million opening for How to Train Your Dragon. And a bigger percentage of Dragon was in 3D, which those tickets cost more, which means less people went to see How to Train Your Dragon.
By far. I mean, Monster vs. Aliens sold 6.4 million tickets opening weekend, and Dragon sold 3.7. That's a huge drop. But that's something we should talk about Lauren Shuker from the Wall Street Journal with.
Well, let's actually get her on the phone right now. Let me dial her up via Skype here. Hello, Lauren?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Great.
Well, thank you for joining us. Lauren Shuker is... Now, what is your title at the Wall Street Journal?
I'm a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
Now, last week you covered a little story that kind of blew up in a way, and that is that movie theaters, at least a few of them here in the United States, are raising their ticket prices mostly for 3D and 3D IMAX films. Can you tell us a little bit about why they might be doing that?
Yeah, well, there are 5 major 3D releases coming out in the next 3 months, and the first one was How to Train Your Dragon, which we saw this weekend. And, you know, every few weeks there's a major release. So we have that movie. We have Clash of the Titans coming next weekend. And I think theater owners sort of thought, well, if we're going to raise prices, we better do it before these films come out and before consumers get used to paying a certain price point for 3D films or films in IMAX. So this last week was sort of the last time to raise those prices. And so we saw the first price hikes introduced this weekend. And, it's still too early to tell sort of how consumers are reacting to those price hikes. But I think over the next month, we'll be able to see whether moviegoers notice the price hikes, which are, you know, as high as $3 in some areas, or whether, they sort of go unnoticed and everyone's willing to pay premium prices.
Well, weren't they already paying a premium, though, to go see a 3D film? Certainly it was between $2.50 and $4 at some theaters just to get the glasses and see a 3D film.
Yeah, I mean, it's, they're already paying premiums, and part of why theater owners wanted to raise prices further is they saw how much, in a film like Avatar, 85% of the box office came from 3D showings and IMAX showings. So consumers were choosing to pay more. The reason why these hikes were significant is that they were pretty big in some markets. So, you know, in some cases you had an adult IMAX ticket going from $16.50 up to $19.50, so almost $20. And that kind of hike is much bigger than we've seen, you know, over the course of the last decade, where the average ticket price really is only going up by 5% or 7% a year.
Were you surprised by the reaction? I mean, the main traditional media had a field day with this. They loved saying, oh my God, movie tickets are $20, $20
yes.
in New York City. My dad called me from Alabama. Movie prices are going up all over the country. You know, they had a field day.
Yeah, and people did segments on how to sneak concessions into theaters, you know. if you didn't want to have to pay another $20 for your popcorn, which of course, you know, is interesting because the movie theaters, tickets are basically split roughly down the middle. The exhibitors get half and the studios get half. But concessions are much more important to the studio's bottom line. I mean, you know, the popcorn, they get all the profits from that. So
you mean the exhibitor's bottom line?
Yeah, sorry, to the exhibitor's bottom line. So, you know, of course, when there are these segments on ticket prices are going up, sneaking your popcorn, I mean, that's even more damaging to the theaters. So,
well, so you'd think that they would actually want to lower ticket prices to get as many people in as possible and get them to buy candy and popcorn.
Yeah, I mean, that's economically, that's always a difficult thing for the theaters because, you know, the concessions matter to their bottom line. So they need to, again, exactly as you said, they have to pack the seats. At the same time, you know, when you see showings of Avatar and Alice in Wonderland in 3D sell out and no one is buying the 2D tickets, you know, there is the thought of maybe consumers would pay a few extra dollars here. So, you know, I think for the theater owners, it's always kind of a risk. And I think if consumers react very badly over the next month to these ticket hikes, we could see a little bit of a retreat from the theater owners. I think this is sort of being seen as an experiment and seeing how moviegoers react.
Well, we were just talking about how fewer people saw How to Train Your Dragon, 3.7 million people, which I believe you pointed out in your article last night. Mm-hmm. And what was it, like 7.4 million people?
6.4 million.
Or 6.3 or so, yeah.
Saw, just a year earlier, saw Monsters vs. Aliens. And if you go all the way back to Shrek, which earned $42.3 million in its opening weekend with an average ticket price of $5.65, 7.5 million people estimated saw that opening. So
right.
Isn't there some kind of supply and demand, price affecting supply and demand issue going on here?
In some ways. I mean, in other ways, you know, attendance actually has been, it's now back up. But for some years, sort of until 2008, attendance was falling or pretty flat. And ticket prices were being raised. So you sort of saw revenues increase with fewer people going to the movies. However, last year, attendance was up significantly. And this year, it's up, I think, like 6 or 7% over last year. So, there are, part of the advantage of higher ticket prices is that you get more out of fewer people. But I do think people are going to the movies, and if they, you know, that is part of what led to this ticket price hike last week, is that, you know, for the first time in a decade, we're seeing a huge resurgence of people going to the movies.
Well, that's exactly when you should raise ticket prices as a business, right? I mean,
right.
If you look at the Knots, they sold more tickets in the 2000s than they did in the 90s, and they sold more in the 90s than the 80s, and the 80s more in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So admissions, decade by decade, year by year, you can see ups and downs. But decade by decade, admissions are up. Worldwide box office is at $30 billion, a record. U.S. box office set a record. They have all these other revenue streams that didn't exist 30 years ago, like DVD and pay-per-view and streaming and online and rentals. So if they've never had more demand for their products. So when else would you raise your prices?
Right. And we're also at a time where the box office, as you said, is up enormously in all these different ways, whereas DVDs have declined and declined and declined and are no longer the sort of rich gold mine they once were for the studios. So, you know, we're seeing these price hikes are also a reflection, I think, and obviously the exhibitors set the prices, but they're a reflection of the fact that for the studios, you know, theatrical is a much more important revenue source than it used to be. Because DVD is just it just doesn't produce the same kind of revenue it used to, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
In fact, last year, for the first time in quite a while, theatrical receipts outpaced DVD sales by about $1 million. Oh, sorry, $1 billion.
Oh, that doesn't include rental. DVD total grosses were about $16, $17 billion. So they still make more money on DVD. But isn't that really just the sort of leveling off of a new product? It's not that DVDs have collapsed. It's just that when you introduce CDs or DVDs, people buy some for a while aggressively, and then they've got their library, and then they buy a sort of a more reasonable amount every year. It's just settled down to where it should be.
Well, it is. I think there are two things going on. One, it's, you know, it's a maturing, as you said, it's a maturing product, and that's what happens, and that's what happened to VHS. But the attempts to introduce new products like Blu-ray, they have, you know, or even video on demand, have yet to pick up the slack. So I think, you know, I think that when with the recession last year and you know really hit retail, I think DVD got hit more than the studios expected.
But isn't that one of the part of the problem? Instead of making their product more appealing by adding on stuff to it, like DVD was the same price or less than VHS, but it was mm-hmm. better picture quality, better sound. You had commentary tracks, bonus features, extra scenes, blah, all this stuff that they didn't have before. And now, but it was the same price or less, so people loved it. Now with movies, they've got 3D. They could be saying, hey, look, keep coming to the movies. We've got new fun stuff for you. Instead, they're trying to charge you through the hilt for it. You know, if you've got half the people going to see, practically half going to see Dragon as opposed to Monsters versus Aliens, in 5 years they'll sell 1,000 tickets for $1,000 and, you know, make the same amount of money, but they can't keep going that way.
Yeah, there is that risk, but I think that this decision was based on the fact if you looked at Avatar and you looked at Alice in Wonderland, you saw consumers willing to pay these higher prices. But, you know, as we know, every film is different. Every film is individual. And that's what makes this business so interesting. You know, it's very hard to make a decision on a whole industry based on two movies. I mean, those films could be anomalies. They, you know, they performed incredibly well. And it might be the consumers aren't willing to pay those premiums for films that they don't see that are as good as Avatar and Alice.
Well, so, talk about the danger of Clash of the Titans. And you know what I mean, that they took a 2D film and pretended it was 3D and are trying to charge a premium for a movie that will not deliver visually the way it should.
Right. Well, they converted it into 3D as an after process, which I think Alice was as well, actually. But they did it quicker with Clash. And I think this weekend will be a very important indicator of do audiences buy this kind of retrofitted 3D, or do you really have to do it from the start, the way Alice, you know, the way Avatar was done, the way Dragon was done? So we'll see. I mean, the early reviews of Clash in 3D have not been great, but it's still early. If it does work, I can guarantee you a lot of studios will do that quick retrofitting because it's much cheaper.
Well, another industry raised prices recently, the music industry. They went from 99 cents to $1.29 for the most part on iTunes, and what they found was that their revenues went up, but their number of sales decreased. And so they kind of got the best of both worlds. They were able to cry poor to Congress and say, you know, why they need certain laws passed. And then they got to turn around to the shareholders and say, revenues are up.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, the film industry doesn't have the same issue there, but we'll see what happens.
Long term, I don't know. I'm already, as a consumer, starting to resent having to pay $3 extra to see a movie in 3D. I don't think it's a gimmick. I think it can be done well, and part of, you know, it's going to be part of summer blockbusters and big family films for years, you know, forever probably. But I do already, when there's a 3D film every week, I do resent that I got to pay this premium just to see the movie. You know, I don't pay a premium for color or sound. Why am I paying a premium for 3D? I know the screens cost more, but shouldn't they just be happy to be getting us in the theater? I think audiences are going to start, like families are going to start saying, gee, you know, do I need, it's a lot of extra money.
Yeah, well, I think the hope is that audiences don't notice, I think. And that's sort of why they raised prices when they did, because we now have a real saturation of the 3D market. And I think the idea is that if you raise these prices early, by the time, you know, you're going to Toy Story and to Shrek Forever After in June, May and June, you're sort of used to paying that $3 premium. But, you know, I think if consumers do take notice, it could be a problem.
Well, it's a $3 premium on top of the premium that was already there. I mean, do you think these kinds of prices will actually spur the sale of 3D-enabled televisions?
It might, though. I think that, you know, the early adopters who buy those 3D televisions, I think, you know, they're not usually concerned about minimal price hikes like that. I'm not sure, you know, that a family doesn't want to pay $16, so they buy a really expensive 3D television early on. I think those will really take a number of years to sort of saturate the market. It's still very early.
Well, Lauren, thank you very much for joining us to tell us all about these ticket price hikes. We'll place links to both of your stories in our show notes. Is there anything else we should place a link to, a Twitter account or
that's it. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
She was great.
Yeah, and I've got a question for you, Karen. How come it is that you are the social media maven, and yet every time we have a guest, you, like Lauren, you will, that's more businessy oriented, we never hear from you?
I don't see what being a social media maven has anything to do with interviewing people. I'm not a very good interviewer.
Oh, it's just like, you know, antisocial, you know, kind of.
I'm extremely antisocial.
Oh, okay. Well,
I hate people. Just because I work in social media doesn't mean I have to like people. And honestly, you guys do such a good job, and this is like your skill set, that I just let you guys do what you do best. There's no need for me to be there.
Oh, shucks. Go on. No, it's seriously, true. Go on.
Well, whatever 3D movies come out next week, it's a shame we won't have At the Movies anymore to cover it. It's been a long time since anybody really paid attention to the syndicated program, but At the Movies, which launched Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel decades ago, has finally ceased production, even though it was, you know, airing at 2 a.m. on Saturdays and nobody really paid attention to it anymore. But it's still an end of an era. But there is good news on the horizon, isn't there, Sperling?
Well, yes, Roger Ebert, who we've talked about previously, and well, I think
Are you going to explain who he is to people?
Well, he's a film critic who. Well, wait a second.
That was a joke that you walked right into.
I walked right into it and then put the dirt right on top of myself. Yeah, I mean, he is, with his wife Kaz, is going to start his own show, Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert presents At the Movies. I guess he owns the At the Movies moniker. No date for when it will be aired or when it will debut. And actually, I should correct you, Michael. It appears that At the Movies will continue production until August. And of course, the New York Times film critic A.O. Scott and the Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips are hosting that show now. And I don't even think they've been hosting it for a year.
Right. No, there's just an end date in sight. They've pulled the plug and episodes are still being produced to fill out contracts. But in 6 months, it'll be gone.
Yes. And on Ebert's blog, he announced his intentions of continuing to pursue Roger Ebert Presents At the Movies. And he says that you shouldn't blame the two hosts of At the Movies that are doing it now, Phillips and Scott. He says, blame the fact that cable TV and the internet have fragmented the audience so much that stations are losing market share no matter what they do.
I have such fond memories of this show. Don't you guys remember watching it like on Sundays at like 6?
Absolutely.
That's what it was, in Northern California.
Yes,
and I
absolutely.
Never, ever agreed with Ebert. I always agreed with Siskel.
And I always liked Ebert more.
Of course.
Well, of course, Ebert has undergone some surgery over the past couple of years, which have left him without the ability to speak. So he intends to, appear on the show periodically, maybe to do a wrap-up of Cannes or a wrap-up of the Toronto Film Festival, but he was actually out in Los Angeles a week or two ago doing some video tests for the hosts of the show.
If he can't speak, how is he going to host a show?
Well, he's not going to host it.
I mean, even when he does his drop-bys.
It's just his name introducing it, and if he appears, he'll just pre-program his voice to, narrate whatever clips or things he's showing.
I just wonder, I think what's really interesting to at least debate or guess is who he was out here doing tests with.
Well, it wasn't me.
Well, I mean...
It was me.
Well, you know, David Poland has appeared on his show a couple of times after Gene Siskel passed away. Kim Morgan is another critic that could potentially be selected. Karina Longworth, who now works for the LA Weekly, is a very smart critic. Kenneth Turan works for the LA Times. Joe Morgenstern is out here and works for the Wall Street Journal. I don't know. It could be a very interesting mix of film critics.
Well, I'm more interested in what it is. Is it a syndicated show? Is it a cable show? I mean, if he's going to try and syndicate this thing, I think that's a very bad idea. I don't understand why American Movie Classics, AMC or TCM, wouldn't want this show. It would be very cheap to make. It seems to be a perfect fit for either one of those channels. And if it's not on those channels, it should not be syndicated. It should just go online. He talks a lot about he wants to Twitter and do this and all new media stuff.
I think it'd be great online.
Yeah, just post it online. They're syndicating it is a ridiculous idea. If they're literally going to try and strip it around the country, a weekly half-hour show about the movies, it's a bad idea.
Well, you know, of course, he comes from syndication. At the Movies was syndicated. It got its start on PBS in the late 70s. But
yes, in the late 70s. And he's a new media guy. He's always been on the edge of new media. It should either be online or it should be on one of those cable channels where it makes a perfect fit.
Or both. Actually, it should be both.
Yeah, I agree with Karen. It should be both.
Oh, well, we'll have any show will have an online component. Yeah, absolutely. But I'm saying you don't even necessarily need to be on TV. I've been trying to get someone to do a TV review show like At the Movies for television. I don't know why they've tried it once or twice, not well. But if you had two people reviewing TV shows, I think it's a natural.
Let's do it.
Let's do it, baby. We got to do video, though.
That would be fine.
Yeah, okay. And you don't even like your picture to be shown.
Oh, my God. I forgot to send you my picture.
You have a picture?
I forgot to send you my picture. That's right. I'm sorry.
Unbelievable. Well, another show that will no longer be on the air is one that a few more people watch and it airs during prime time, and that's 24.
I'm very sad. I was big on this show at the beginning. I wrote a lot of stories about it, interviewed Kiefer and the people behind it. I thought it was a great concept, really well delivered. It has very up and down seasons. You know, some seasons are awful, some seasons are good. This season has some really dumb storylines, but it is definitely a landmark show. Did you ever watch it, Karen?
I gave up about halfway through the first season, finding it one of the most unwatchable shows I've ever attempted to watch.
we should do a TV show.
I understand that I am wrong, okay? But from what I understand, the writers simply ran out of ideas. I mean, I think this show it was done. Creatively,
oh,
it was done. I think it was
they should
the best
have ended
time
it last year or 2 years ago. Last year was a good year. They stormed the White House and took the president hostage. What more could you do after that? And
yeah,
that was
right?
Halfway
ended there.
Through the season.
Well, and this is a show that each episode was an hour of a given day. So the whole show over the course of a season took place in one day.
Yeah.
But I understand that the movie version is not going to be like that.
Ah, so okay, a couple things. One, the Kiefer you refer to, Michael, is Kiefer Sutherland. I did not know that you were on a first name basis with the star of 24. But yes. Kiefer Sutherland, the actor, is actually very excited about doing a movie version of 24. Hopefully it won't be 24 hours long, though.
No, it will be set in Europe, and it will not have the time constraint thing that, you know, made the television show, which means it will not be unique and have nothing to do with what made 24 special.
Revisit your favorite characters, right? I mean, don't you guys like the characters?
Well, there are some. They changed a lot of characters over the years because they realized they couldn't have the same characters in trouble every season, the same twists and turns. And so they sort of reboot the cast every 2 or 3 years, except for Kiefer. And we are good friends. We both love rodeo. He was a roper in the rodeo circuit for a year or two when his career was down. So Kiefer and I have a lot in common.
You were what? Are you a roper?
Kiefer was. He was actually a healer in calf roping on the rodeo circuit.
And that's how you guys became friends. That's great.
Yeah, I interviewed him about that.
Oh, okay.
And we're not friends, of course. But the show is very expensive. Fox paid $5 million per episode this season. And they went to NBC with the show and offered it to them at $3.5 million an episode, even though they had no ideas what to do for day nine. And NBC turned it down. But I love how that makes NBC look like the sad little network that will take shows. You know, NBC is so desperate for programming. They're like, you want 24? But even they turned it down. But what a landmark show. I mean, the way it's scheduled is very revolutionary. The time format is revolutionary. The way it's scheduled, starting in mid-season, no reruns. That's imitated by everyone now because you just can't do reruns of dramas, especially serialized dramas. And it's just the way of the future. It's a very influential show.
No, I totally agree. But I don't have as much problem with the fact that the movie is not going to be based on an entire day because I do think people want to revisit some of those characters, like Kiefer Sutherland's character and Marilyn Rice Cub. They like those characters.
Yeah, she's a great character.
Well, how much money do you think a movie version of 24 could make in 4 weeks at the box office? And would you be willing to put money down on that bet?
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this story.
Yes. Well, when I was at Show West, I actually ran into some of the folks from HSX.com, which is the Hollywood Stock Exchange, a site I used to work for back in the late 90s. Well, that site was purchased by Cantor Fitzgerald, the big investment bank and Wall Street stock brokerage firm, and they are launching the Cantor Exchange, which is a futures market for motion picture box office. It is incredibly difficult to explain, and you really have to know what futures are and how they work, and effectively what you'd be doing is placing a wager on how much money a movie would make in its first 4 weeks of domestic box office. So, for instance, if 24 the movie were trading at $63 per share, you could buy a number of shares with real money, 63 real US dollars. You'd put that down and you'd make an offer to buy them, meaning that you think it will make more than $63. And then, of course, you'd collect the difference. Somebody would have to purchase those shares, but basically purchase your bet, thinking, well, it's not going to make $63 million. I think it's going to make $30 million. So I'll take that bet. So it really is an exchange. It's incredibly complicated. I sat there for an hour with these guys, and I've been trying to get them on the show. I was going to do it in April at some point when their exchange should go live if it is approved by the FCC. However, the Motion Picture Association of America, the same group that gives us our movie ratings here in the United States, is dead set against this exchange. And Bob Pisano called it unbridled gambling, which, when it was being explained to me in Las Vegas at Show West, all I could think is, wait a second, this is just gambling.
That's what all futures trading is. It's always gambling. You're gambling on the price of wheat 6 months from now, a year from now. That is how the futures market works. It is gambling.
How is this different from a story we talked about a couple of weeks ago about Hollywood Stock Exchange now using real money?
Well, there's going to be two different exchanges, the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which is a game, and then there's going to be the Cantor Exchange, which is an actual market and exchange with money trading hands.
Okay. That really does affect something.
Yeah, correct. It's going to be with real money, but the thing is it won't really affect movies, or at least that's what Cantor is saying. The MPAA is saying potentially that's not true, and it could be otherwise, that it will affect movies. Now, mind you, insider trading in futures is actually allowed. A corn grower can purchase futures for his crop to hedge so that if his crop comes in underproducing, he or she could actually earn some of that money back on the futures market. Well, in the case of the Cantor Exchange, somebody who has produced or put up money for a particular film will be allowed to invest in their film, not invest in the film, but purchase, I guess, shares in their film, up to 50% of the budget of the movie. So if they paid $50 million to make the film, they can wager 25% of that, so $25 million. Sorry, 50% of that, $25 million.
See, it's even hard for you to explain.
Exactly.
But it's interesting. It's gambling on the movies, and the MPAA hates it.
Yeah, Greg Fraser, the executive vice president of the Movie Association, said, at a minimum, the commission should hold off on any rulings until after there's a public discussion about the ramifications. And the commission he's referring to is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And what I found funny was, what do you mean a public discussion? We've been talking about this for weeks, and HSX has been around for how long now? Where have you been?
Well, they mean a formal, they don't mean chatting on blogs. They mean a formal government inquiry in which people are invited to speak and offer their expert opinion.
What do you think the Futures Trading Commission has been doing? You think they've just been like, I don't know, Cantor, tell us what you want to do so we can approve you.
Have they had public hearings?
Yes.
I don't believe so.
Well, yeah, they do a full investigation and they were set
to go
live. No.
They're talking about a public hearing, congressmen, senators, people sitting, bringing in people, talking, having a public discussion, inviting formal statements from organizations.
Well, while I may not understand this entirely, I mean, I do, but, you know, while it's difficult to understand, the reality is the energy market, agriculture, there are tons of markets and industries that have futures exchanges. So what's the difference?
The difference is that when you buy a wheat future, you're literally purchasing the right to buy wheat, whatever. This is simply imaginary that has nobody's, you're just making bets. So while it's all gambling, there is actual wheat involved. In this case, you're just gambling on things that are happening. It's like sports gambling.
You know, I think that's actually a misconception, and not to stay too long on this story, but I think that is a misconception that you're actually buying the wheat or you're buying the energy. I think really you're just gambling on the price of that energy and the price of that wheat. You're wagering on a price that it will get on a specific date. That's it. I don't think you actually get the commodity.
Well, no, you sell it off before you sell it off before you have to. But it is in fact related to reality. It's not simply gambling. It is in fact you can't purchase the rights to $7 trillion worth of wheat if there isn't $7 trillion worth of wheat out in the world.
We'll have to get them on and pick their brains on how this whole thing works.
Maybe you should Twitter them.
Twitter them? Well, yeah, you know, I don't know. If I don't Twitter them, though, will I get arrested?
Exactly.
Hey, how's that for a segue?
We're not supposed to segue, but I did see Justin Bieber perform on David Letterman. He did his new number. He's dancing his little ass off. He looked great. It was very funny. But he's in the news. He's on every teen magazine. And you can see he's on Tiger Beat and Teen Go. And I was in the drugstore and I just saw Justin Bieber everywhere. He has a new album coming out. But he's a Canadian kid who was discovered on YouTube and met with like huge record producer people and, you know, has launched this massive career. He sort of like skipped the American Idol stage and went straight to Teen Idol. And
I love how Conan O'Brien has made him like his nemesis on Twitter.
Yeah, that's
funny.
Are
you following that?
Yeah. And so he's got everything good going, except there was one little fill-up, which is that his manager was formally arrested for not tweeting.
Well, and here's what I think is really interesting about this is that, you know, supposedly he was told by the cops or something to send out a Twitter saying that this event had been canceled.
Right. There was an event at a mall in November and too many people showed up.
Right. And so he was told to send out a Twitter that it had been canceled. And his lawyers are saying, yeah, he did. He sent out, you know, a couple of tweets within 7 minutes. And the cops are saying, no, it took 2 hours. Has anyone thought to just go to the guy's Twitter stream and look?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely ludicrous. This story will be buried at some point because that's all you really need to do. It's those
go to
things
the guy's
are date
Twitter stream,
and timestamp. Yeah.
What the hell?
Well, but surely, I mean, surely they have.
Who knows?
Well, that's what I find so bizarre. This article doesn't say it. I don't know what the guy's Twitter stream is. I haven't gone, you know, I haven't done any research. I suppose you could find it really easily. But I just think it's really strange. And I think it has to do with people's ignorance of how social media works. Because I'm finding this more and more these days. And it just baffles me.
Yes, but then again, you work in that arena.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, to me, a lot of this is common sense, but what's common sense to me is not necessarily common sense to anybody else. And I think that maybe the cops just didn't know that you can go and look. But it's also really, actually, it's very interesting the way that they asked him to send out a tweet. Yeah, I just thought that was interesting, too.
Well, I think it's pretty smart that they realized, hey, let's use this to tell people to stay away. You know, let's say I thought it was at least a little more aware of the Twitter world than you might expect the cops to be. How can you let people know right away, stay away, tell them via Twitter, it ain't happening.
And that if you don't do it via that new medium, then you could be arrested.
Which is really ridiculous. For what? Like, it was like inciting mayhem or something? What was the exact charge?
I'm not sure, but obviously you can get an extraordinary number of fans showing up to these mall events, and it can be dangerous and put people in danger. And if you want to shut it down, you should use every reasonable means to do so. I don't think it was unreasonable of them to say, hey, please send out a Twitter.
No, I agree. That wasn't unreasonable, but it's completely unreasonable to charge him with reckless endangerment and criminal nuisance. I don't know. To me, a charge like that really requires active participation, not the fact that you did not take active participation. I don't know. The legal thing, I'm sure.
When it's your 14-year-old daughter getting crushed in those fans.
Good. She's a Justin Bieber fan?
You know, I have to admit, I had no idea who Justin Bieber was, and I just kept seeing this name appear on Twitter, and I was like, who is this guy? I have no idea. And, you know, then, of course, he's appearing on all these award shows, and I'm just thinking, wow, like, I am so out of it that I did not know who this kid was and what makes him so popular.
Well, who was it? Somebody recently said that they thought that Justin Bieber was really just a lesbian.
Oh, I have no idea.
Well, no, that's it's a website for people who look like aging lesbians. It's not that they thought he was a lesbian. It's just a joke website where they show pictures of celebrities next to lesbians that look like them.
Well, I'll tell you something. If that isn't a sure sign that we should jump right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we decide whether the top news stories of the week are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them, then I don't know what is.
Go for it. All right.
Well, our first story is about John Edgar Wideman, who is an award-winning novelist. He's won 2 Pen Faulkner Awards, and he was nominated for the National Book Award. He is going to publish his next book on Lulu, so he's going to self-publish his next book. I found it interesting in reading the article about this that Daniel, his son, works for Lulu. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Just like music stars can now release their own albums digitally to their fans and reap all the profits and don't need a record label, we could be seeing the future for books where once a writer is established, they don't need a publisher. What's the point? What do they do? They don't edit. They do very little for the book. And if you can distribute it digitally, what do you need them for?
Karen?
I totally agree. It's a big deal for the same reason. And it's actually, Lulu's been around for a while. It's kind of nice to see it get its props.
Well, yeah, I mean, self-publishing for... well, as long as books have been around, has been kind of the place that you go when your book is no good or no publisher will pick it up. In this case, what Wideman is saying is that publishing has become such a blockbuster-driven industry, much like the movies.
Movies, yeah.
Where they, you know, publishers will pay a celebrity or a politician millions of dollars to write a book, but smaller titles can't or won't get released, that he's just going to do it on his own. I just wonder whether the iPad, which is being released by Apple this week, will actually increase the number of self-published titles and successful self-published titles.
I think if Kindle didn't, why would iPad?
Well,
Kindle has, and iPad will too. If it's a successful reading device, then yeah, it'll help. If it's not, it won't.
Well, while John Edgar Wideman is publishing his own book, it turns out a book publisher will be publishing a book from Jersey Shore castmates. They will be writing a book. It's a Guido guide entitled Never Fall in Love at the Jersey Shore. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
What the hell's a Guido guide?
I don't know. It's what
Guide to Being a Guido.
Yeah, it's what Media Bistro called it.
Oh, I thought this was like something that like had been, you know, lots of Guido guides have been published, you know, like for dummies. This is a big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal. Who knew they could read?
Let alone write.
Who knew they could write, yeah.
Well, speaking of writing, Jamie Foxx, the actor, the music sensation, the multi-hyphenate, is adding another hyphenate, and that is to become a screenwriter. He is going to be writing the screenplay for the Laverne and Shirley movie. And of course, Laverne and Shirley was the popular, I guess it was 1970s, early 80s sitcom. Hey, you know what? Some people can't remember.
70s.
1970s sitcom produced by Gary Marshall, starring his sister, Penny Marshall, who later became a director, and Cindy Williams. Jennifer Garner will be playing Laverne. Jessica Biel would play Shirley, according to Gary Marshall. Jamie Foxx is writing the screenplay. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
The casting is a big whoop. And it's a big whoop because it's such a bizarre fit. Jamie Foxx to write the screenplay for Laverne and Shirley, but whatever. Maybe he's a big fan of the show.
Karen?
Well, I would say it's a huge deal for Jamie Foxx. But no, I agree with Michael. It's a real big whoop in terms of the casting. What bad choices.
Well, I just want to know, I mean, Jessica Biel and Jennifer Garner, I mean, these are two beautiful women. And wasn't the whole point of the sitcom that Laverne and Shirley were kind of, you know,
average gals.
Yeah,
give me Kristen Wiig and Amy Poehler.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. It's very bad casting. There's another project in the works, slightly different from Laverne and Shirley. It's that Dustin Lance Black, the Oscar-winning screenwriter of Milk, is working with Clint Eastwood on a biopic of J. Edgar Hoover, which I'm not sure why it hasn't happened before. The closeted cross-dressing FBI head. Is that a big deal or a big whoop? Karen?
Big deal. You say this is the first time? I swear to God, I must have seen several of them. And maybe it's just that he appears in lots of movies from that time.
Exactly. He appears in lots of movies, but his own biopic, finally.
Well, yeah.
Sperling?
Eh.
Clint Eastwood, one of the hottest directors of the last 10 years and the Oscar-winning screenwriter. I also think it's a big whoop, but it's Clint Eastwood's a bad fit. You know, ironic, black-humored film about J. Edgar Hoover. Clint Eastwood, what does he know about cross-dressing? Nothing.
Well, I wish I was Jon Stewart. I could come up with some witty...
Maybe Justin Bieber should do it.
No. I think it should be I think Matt Damon would be a good fit for J. Edgar Hoover.
He would, actually.
Yeah.
Well, our next story is about some casting news for Transformers 3. It appears, according to Michael Bay, who wrote on his blog, that John Malkovich, Frances McDormand, and Ken Jeong will be appearing in the film, along with, of course, Shia LaBeouf and Megan Fox and everybody
else. She is so hot.
Okay, well, he has cast those three actors and actresses, only one actress, really, in Transformers 3. And if you don't know Ken Jeong, he was the doctor and Knocked Up and was stuck in the trunk of a car in The Hangover. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, it's a huge franchise, but who cares who's in it?
Karen?
I agree. Same reason.
You got to give it a little more, like, you know, guttural oomph. Well, that sounds like you're in pain. Yikes.
I was when I tried to watch Transformers 2.
Well, our next story is about Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska and former vice presidential candidate who ran on John McCain's ticket. Well, now she's going to have her own reality series produced by Mark Burnett, who you might remember from Survivor and other reality shows. Well, she is going to do a show called, I guess, Alaska.
That might be a working title. Sarah Palin's Alaska.
Sarah Palin's Alaska. Because, you know, we really just want to see her Alaska, nobody else's.
Well, no, Sarah Palin owns Alaska.
Oh, okay. Well, each show will cost more than $1 million to produce, and to put that in perspective, most of the shows that appear on the Learning Channel, which is where Sarah Palin's Alaska will appear, cost between $200,000 and $400,000. Hers will cost $1 million. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, I think ultimately it's big whoop, but I'm going to watch it. I don't know about you guys. I think it sounds interesting. Not because of her, but because of Alaska, so.
Michael?
But also, big whoop, ultimately.
It's a big deal. She still wants to run for president, and she thinks doing a reality show can help her. So if Blagojevich can be on Celebrity Apprentice, why can't Sarah Palin be on the Learning Channel?
So let me get this straight. If Blagojevich is on Celebrity Apprentice...
Blagojevich!
I mean, that is the place where celebrities go to die. You know, it's becoming, like, except for So You Think You Can Dance or Dancing with the Stars or whatever that reality show is, for the most part, it's celebrities that are has-beens.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all.
The
it's
surreal
people
life?
Who are looking, people who are looking, did you say the surreal life?
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about the Celebrity Apprentice.
No, I'm just talking about reality shows in general.
The Celebrity Apprentice has got a strange, like, it seems to be sort of okay to do it. Like Jesse James did it.
Yeah, well, look at where he is these days.
No, but I mean, if he did it now, that'd be one thing. But he did it, you know, last year or maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, Cyndi Lauper's doing it. And yeah, you could argue she's a has-been, but I would say that she never went away. She's still equally important.
Hey, she just wants to have fun, you know?
I don't know. I mean, Michael, you probably have a better sense about this than I do because you love reality shows more. But I would say that The Celebrity Apprentice is kind of a genre in its own.
I fall somewhere between the two. I don't like reality shows. I like talent shows, but the reality shows I virtually never watch. But there are plenty of big name celebrities who associate themselves with them. So I don't think it's any sort of slur on you to be involved. And this is on the Learning Channel. So I think it's more surprising that they would want to do business with her, given her high negatives, frankly, than that she would want to be on the Learning Channel. But
she's worth a gazillion bucks. Look how well her book did.
her book did do well and the show will do well. You just said you'd like to see it, but you know, she has to be in every episode for it to work. If she's not in it, you know, big time, then it's not going to be as much fun. And she thinks it's going to help her become president. She's a commentator on Fox News. She's, you know, it's just sort of like Bill Clinton going on Arsenio Hall and playing the sax. You know, it's just the rules change always about what you can do to remain politically viable.
Yeah, you betcha.
Well, our inside baseball topic this week is about the Hollywood trade papers trying to remain viable. Variety has been telling studios that they should stop giving scoops to the competition, and if they continue to give scoops to the competition, especially the online competition specifically is what they're referring to, then they won't run their big announcements in the trade papers.
Well, what I love about this is their threat is that we'll only post it online. We won't print it. And that is such a clueless threat. It's like, oh, it won't be in the print edition, which nobody even cares about anymore. You know, the only reason they exist is so you can run Oscar ads. It will only be online, which is where most people want to read it anyway. So what kind of a threat is that? It's just moronic.
Yes, Patrick Goldstein uncovered this. He's with the LA Times. And he called Tim Gray, who copped to it. He said, yeah, you know, we simply said that if you give any of these show business websites the story first, then we'll put the story on the web for the record, but we won't put it in the print edition. And the reality is, most people don't read the print edition anymore.
Yeah, you know, news to Variety, it is not the 1980s anymore. They're so clueless. Michael, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just astounding how clueless this is.
I liked what one PR executive had to say. He said, the minute we have a meeting or make a decision, it's up on someone's blog. We're not the announcer anymore. We're the responder to what someone's already written. All we can do most of the time is damage control. Well, my first thought was, well, then control who's in your meetings. I mean, that would be the first thought.
Kick the interns out.
Exactly, for Pete's sake. And of course, really what this is geared at is, you know, Deadline Hollywood, Nikki Fink's blog, and Sharon Waxman's The Wrap are really giving the trade papers a run for their money. In fact, so much so that Nikki Fink published on her blog this week that she was offered the editor-in-chief position over at The Hollywood Reporter, and that, you know, lit up a whole hoo-ha over whether she was really offered the position, and you know, Sharon Waxman had something to say. The Hollywood Reporter denies it. The parent company of The Hollywood Reporter said no way, and she then said, you know, I was offered $450,000 per year plus a $1
million. And a car, right? And a car.
You know, it was a $1 million home in Malibu. This whole thing went back and forth. It was like a cat fight.
Yeah. Do you guys remember Mark Lasanti, who used to be the writer for Defamer and essentially made Defamer what it was?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He tweeted, hey, I'll be the editor-in-chief of Hollywood Reporter if you give me a house in Malibu. And it took me a while to get the context of what he was saying. And then I read this article. He actually wouldn't be a bad choice for it.
Well, Ann Thompson has a great piece on this whole kerfuffle, and it's well worth reading. We'll place a link to it in the show notes, but she said that Deadline's readers aren't worrying about good placement on page one. They want to read the news first, preferably via tweet or text alert, something The Wrap and IndieWire are particularly good at. And they want to engage directly with Waxman and Fink, commenting, complaining, and feeding. It's about talkback, linking, and networking, not about an insular Beverly Hills Burbank corridor. And I have to agree with that.
Which is why they're dumb to have let Roger Freeman's contract lapse at The Hollywood Reporter. His blog was one of the best things about The Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah, you know what? Let's get Roger Freeman on to talk about that a little bit. Hold on just a second. Let me see if I can dial him up here.
Hi.
Hi. Roger, thank you for joining us. We were just talking about the big kerfuffle with Nikki Fink and Sharon Waxman and The Hollywood Reporter and Patrick Goldstein's column last week in the LA Times about the Variety telling the studios not to give the quote-unquote online competition basically scoops. And now you are one of those online competitors. You were with The Hollywood Reporter and you decided to part ways and you're off on your own.
It seems like that, for the time being, at least.
Oh, are you looking to actually land someplace else? The blog is showbiz411, we should say.
Showbiz411.com. No, I think for the time being, I'm gonna stay the course and see how it develops. It's sort of fun to do, and it's been really popular just in the week that we've been doing it. So we'll see how it goes.
There was a lot of talk about, well, gee, you know, it seems like The Hollywood Reporter didn't pick up your contract just a week after you broke this big news story about Rosie O'Donnell. There seemed to be a lot of question asking around Hollywood as to what The Hollywood Reporter was thinking. Do you have any idea? What were they thinking?
I have no idea what they're thinking. But my contract with them was always supposed to expire on March 31st, and it was designed that way from the beginning. It was just a coincidence that the Rosie O'Donnell thing happened as it was expiring. But I don't know. The state of the trades is very curious to me. I don't know what's going on.
Well, does there seem to be any reason for a print edition of the trades anymore? It seems like a daily version of the print media. It just seems outdated by the time it gets in your hands. Isn't online where they really need to be, except that they want the ads for the Oscar. That's where they make so much money. So they're sort of caught in a – they're most effective online, but they still need the print edition just to print the ads.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably they should just have weekly editions. The daily edition doesn't seem to really matter anymore. I mean, I can't believe – outside of having it on a coffee table and people reading it while they're waiting for an appointment, I can't believe that anybody's waiting for the daily edition of the trades in print. Everything is online. Everything breaks online. And the whole structure of the business has changed completely in the last couple of years. And I think the trades are slow to acknowledge that.
How has that affected your work and the work you do on Showbiz 411?
Oh, it changed. It's my work since when I was at Fox News for 10 years and at Fox News, I basically posted once a day in the early in the morning. I had new stuff up, and sometimes in the afternoon, if something happened, we would do an update. That's changed completely in the last year and a half, where suddenly you had to be a wire service and be posting constantly. And in a way, that's a good thing because it certainly keeps people up to date, but it's also kind of a bad thing because I laugh sometimes when I see these stories that are of complete minutia and of very little interest to anybody being touted as exclusives and being posted 4 and 5 times a day on different blogs. It sort of cracks me up because who cares, really? It's so minor, and it could wait until the next day or it could wait until there's a batch of stories. But I get these breaking alerts from various websites and publications. And when you click on it, it's something of no importance whatsoever. So everything has become of the same importance now. You know, if somebody sneezes or makes a deal with a foreign, buyer, that's something I need to know right now? I don't think so.
Well, I think it's all about trying to be first. So even if you have just a one-sentence update, you want to tell it to everybody first, because if you say it first, then you're more of an authority in the space than someone else.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, there's only so much of an authority you can be. At some point, your readers have to trust that you're an authority in general and that they'll come to you to read stuff. But, to have to be the first to break every single thing that happens, it's not important.
No, I'd much rather have a site like yours where I know I'm going to go and find something that's going to be interesting and maybe not on every other site. And therefore, it's worth my time to go through it rather than sites
right,
where they just fill it up with every damn thing in the world. It just becomes noise.
And then it's just noise. And then you Google it. If you take a subject and you Google it, and then you find 250 repetitions of the same thing within 5 minutes of each other, well, what was the point of that effort? There's just no – it's not right.
Well, that's why Variety going behind a paywall – I mean, what's the point? Even behind the paywall, they publish some bit of news, and then a million bloggers wind up getting hold of it. And I'm not talking about yourself, Nikki Fink, or Sharon Waxman. I'm talking about...
Well, Nikki Fink slaps up press releases. Nikki Fink press releases and slaps them up and says exclusive. And then the same press release is everywhere 5 minutes later or 2 minutes before. So I don't even understand that. That is one thing about her column that really makes me laugh, because 9/10 of the stuff that she puts up is just press releases.
Well, do you see yourself as a competitor to Nikki Fink at Deadline and The Wrap?
No. Well, The Wrap I don't really read, so I have trouble getting to it. I don't know. And Nikki Fink, I read occasionally. Usually when I think that she's defaming me or someone I know, which is, there's always something going on there that looks halfway, litigious. she's personally just, her column is really about being mean to people. She likes to be personally mean, take swipes at people, they're ad hominem attacks. It has absolutely nothing to do with journalism or reporting. It's just like, she's like the girl who was unpopular in high school and now wants to attack everyone. She should star in a remake of Carrie. I feel like, no, really, I'll tell you, Michael Fleming is great. And he went there for whatever reasons he went, and he's doing the bulk of the work. And I feel like he's really competition because he's so good. And he really gets great stories.
Now, Michael Fleming used to be Variety Scoopmeister. He used to work at Variety. He left Variety to go work with Nikki Fink at Deadline, and I guess he's based in New York.
He's based in New York.
Yeah.
And he's really, since he's been there, he's been hitting a lot of home runs and doing great work.
So what, did you have an amicable parting with Hollywood Reporter, or did they let you know by email or Twitter? Did they actually call you and talk to you about it, or did you know for a while that you were going to be...
The way we constructed our deal in the beginning, it was going to end on March 31st.
But there's a possibility they might have renewed it. I assume at some point, did they just never say anything and it just ended, or did they actually say we're not going to...
Oh, no. I'm on great terms with them. Elizabeth Guider is terrific, and we're going to do stuff in the future. No, it's fine.
Now, you mentioned the word we, you know, what we've been working on. Is there somebody other than yourself working on Showbiz 411?
There may be. I wish somebody else would come in and work on it. but I'll see what develops over the next few weeks.
Okay. Well, we certainly will be watching. We cite it just about every week. Now we can cite it at showbiz411.com. And of course you're also on Twitter. And the username to look up, I believe, is showbiz411, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's showbiz411. And, I always owned that website name. So I just licensed that to the Hollywood Reporter.
Smart.
And actually, my contract doesn't even really end until this week. And also, I'll tell you who's been very nice. There's a new site called HollywoodNews.com. They're featuring my stories as well.
Carlos DeBreo, who does the Hollywood Film Festival, is heading that up.
Well, great. Well, good luck with all your work and all your projects. And we look forward to keep reading you wherever you are hosted.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, you know, Michael, last week when you emailed me asking for Roger's email address and contact information because he hadn't appeared on The Hollywood Reporter in some time, I didn't really think anything of it until later in the week when Ann Thompson mentioned that, you know, he was gone from The Hollywood Reporter.
We could have broken that story. Yeah, suddenly the blog was not on The Hollywood Reporter website, so you knew something was up. I thought maybe he was gone for the weekend, but then when it continued for 3 days, you knew he was gone. And obviously they pulled it like 10 days, I guess, before the contract ended officially. But, you know, but he's been at New York Magazine, at FoxNews.com and Hollywood Reporter, and he'll be somewhere else. But while we've been talking to him, I have been scrolling through the tweets of Justin Bieber, and I have now arrived on November 20th, the day that the event happened. It was at a mall in Garden City, New Jersey, I think.
New York.
It's New York, rather. The Roosevelt Field Mall. 5,000 people showed up, and apparently the mall security was overwhelmed, and they canceled the event earlier in the day. The problem was that after they canceled the event, Justin Bieber posted a tweet, or his manager did, whoever does it, at 2:59 p.m. on November 20th, saying, "On my way to Roosevelt Field Mall in Long Island, New York, to sign and meet fans. I'm pumped. See you there." Then an hour and a half later, he says, "They are not allowing me to come into the mall. If you don't leave, I and my fans will be arrested, as the police just told us. And then the event at Roosevelt Mall is canceled. Please go home. The police have already arrested one person from my camp. I don't want anyone hurt. I'm sorry." Later on, an hour after that, "I'm sorry to everyone who was there, just trying to come meet fans. Never meant to disappoint anyone." So we can believe that perhaps sometime earlier in the day, the police said, "Way too many people are showing up. We're canceling the event." And then they found out that they posted, I'm just theorizing here, at 3 o'clock, saying, "We're on our way." And then another hour and a half later, they finally said, "No, the event is canceled." So that's, you know, that's the issue. When did the cops cancel the event? When did they post their tweet saying, "We're on our way, see you there"?
Well, I've got a question for you. The little post about headed over to the Garden Grove or Garden City Mall.
2:59 p.m., yes.
Right. How was it sent? Was it sent via text message, or was it sent by phone, or
how the hell would I know?
Well, it says via...
say underneath it, sent via TweetDeck or whatever.
Via web. They all say via web.
Okay. So, but the reality is that could have been sent through Tweet Later or some form of...
Yeah, but the point is that they canceled the event earlier in the day, and yet after they canceled the mall canceled the event, the police claim they posted the statement at 3 p.m. saying, "We're on our way, see you there." Well, that's why there's a debate. That's why, you know, if they canceled the event and said, "For safety purposes, please tell your fans you know, not to come, and then you urge them to go there, that's an issue.
Well, I think the debate should be over why we're talking about Justin Bieber in the first place.
Four girls. Hey, he's a hot young star. Four girls were taken to the hospital. You know, people were hurt. You know, he's discovered on YouTube. He's a new media star. It's a fun, weird, you know, life story. He's like 16, 17 years old. He's got a new album out. He's a big, big, hot young teen sensation. But he should know about new media. And it's an interesting issue.
I wonder if we'll be discovered on YouTube. We have a YouTube account and a YouTube channel. So you can actually go to, I think it's youtube.com/showbizsandbox. I'm not sure what it is, but I know where you can find the link, and that is on our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com. In fact, you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn. You'll also find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode. Our website is where you'll also find different ways to contact us, including email. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. As well as leave us a voicemail. You can call 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And in fact, I can't believe this. I forgot to read our listener email, and it actually applies to what I was about to say, MGMT. Patrick from India wrote in. He says, "Dear Sperling SB times 2 team, are you going to let your pod listeners know that MGMT has just released a new album and a darn good one at that?" He used another word there, but I don't know if we're allowed to use it. "Listen to their tracks for free on the band's website, whoismgmt.com, and perhaps they'd lend you one of them to bookend the segments of your show. In fact, I will call them immediately. Keep up the good work. Best wishes, Patrick." Thank you, Patrick, for your email. Hopefully we'll be reading your email next week. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace, as I mentioned at the head of the show. And of course, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, as Patrick so deftly pointed out. You can listen to their tracks for free at their website, whoismgmt.com. You can read Michael Giltz for free on his website. MichaelGiltz.com is the website to look up, or you can read his tweets for free. At Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward charges for her tweets, but if you want to pay for them, Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. And if you want to read her writing, KarenWoodwardOnline.com is the username to look up. If you want to read any of my writing, it can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, or you can read my tweets, and I'll think about whether I charge you or not. At Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.